Nothing is more important than getting a good night's sleep, and when you don't get the rest you need, your whole day is thrown off. That's why it's so important to choose the right mattress. Sleeping on a Purple mattress is truly a unique experience, because Purple mattresses are made with a GelFlex grid. The GelFlex grid is an innovative material that moves with your body to relieve pressure in areas like knees and hips, and support in others, like your back. It feels soft where you want it and supports where you need it. Purple mattresses instantly adapt when you move. You don't sink in and get stuck like with memory foam. And thanks to over 1,400 air chambers in the GelFlex grid, you will sleep cooler on a Purple mattress. Purple has a wide variety of mattresses, from the original Purple mattress to the Restore Hybrid Collection that combines GelFlex grid with coils, and the Rejuvenate Luxe Collection, the height of luxury, with over 112,000 five-star reviews to prove it. Visit purple.com to find the perfect Purple for you and enter code PODCAST10 to get 10% off.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact here in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold of 105.3 The Fan. Before we get started, we would like to start the show with another edition of our Odyssey series, I'm Listening.
From Odyssey, this is Odyssey Conversations. Today, we take you to the Odyssey Sound Space in Los Angeles as KNX news anchors Charles Feldman and Mike Simpson discuss the state of the entertainment industry and how streaming is affecting the creative community and content they produce.
Hollywood's always reflected the changing world around it. Culture, sensibilities, technology.
But we are clearly at an inflection point, coming off a very historic half-year strike, with streaming services rising and old business models falling. So what does the future of the entertainment industry actually look like? And what does this mean for what we all will see on the screen?
Well, that's what we're talking about. We brought together a group of people who are making, distributing, and covering the content. Ron Perlman, veteran actor, writer, producer, might know him as Hellboy, or one of the dozens of characters he's portrayed over the years. Ron, also the founder and director of Wing and a Prayer Studio. Cynthia Littleton, co-editor-in-chief of Variety, which has been covering the news of Hollywood for nearly 120 years. Karina Manishill, president of Mad Solar Productions, company on the leading edge of the film business, creative force behind movies like X and Pearl. We have Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief, general manager of Entertainment Weekly, one of the most widely read sources in the country on the industry, and Duncan Crabtree Ireland, national executive director, chief negotiator for SAG-AFTRA, union representing 160,000 actors, broadcast journalists, recording artists, and performers.
Now, at the end of the show, we are going to take some questions from our studio audience, but we're going to start by, this is not a scientific poll by any means, but we're going to take a quick sample of what you folks think the state of the entertainment industry is now. So what I want to do is I'm going to ask you a question and just shout it out. If you think that the entertainment industry is doing just fine, shout out a good, really heartfelt yes. Wow, we're in trouble. And those of you who think that it's not doing so fine, a no?
No.
Ron Perlman. Like they say, showbiz is your life. What do you think?
I'm with you guys.
Which one? The nose?
I'm in a state of constant mourning over the state of the entertainment industry because of how unrecognizable it is to the power and the glory and the effect that it's had on my thinking about the humanities.
But Ron, do you think that there's any hope for it? I mean, you have a very pessimistic view on it. But
no, I'm incredibly optimistic.
You are.
I just hate the people who are running the show right now. The art form of cinema and television, I guess, is an offshoot of it, was invented by family-run businesses, studios. And the competition and the lust for profits were every bit as real as they are now, but their version of competing with each other was to make better stuff than the next guy did and make sure that it got to the audience as good as it possibly could. So there was a pride of ownership that comes with a mom and pop sort of a business that is completely removed when it's corporate run and corporations started taking over the movie business, the studios, and then the TV studios when I guess I'm not a historian, but around the 50s, the studio started to falter. Gulf Western comes in, Sony comes in, Seagram's comes in, you know, and our entertainment, which was an offshoot of the desire to blow people's minds about being part of a collective consciousness, which is what culture is meant to do, turned into the desire to compete for stock prices. What was always an uneasy relationship between management and labor, the gap right now is the people who are in charge of, when the work finally comes down to those of us who do it, have zero in common with us. Zero. And as long as that is just, I sound pessimistic, but those of us who do it love it more than ever, and we will prevail when we kill the model that's currently in place.
Duncan Crabtree, Ireland, SAG-AFTRA. Where are we now post-strike, given, you know, the thoughts of the audience and the thoughts of Ron here?
Yeah, no, I mean, hearing what Ron said and also with what the audience says, I think last year reflects that, right? Like, what happened last year reflected the fact that there was a feeling among certainly the members of SAG-AFTRA, exemplified by Ron and many others, who not only, you know, supported the idea of a strike, but actually got out there, were on picket lines, were at rallies, were doing things, not just saying things, but doing things to try and help change the business, to help move it in the right direction, to move it in a direction that is less, you know, perhaps about the audience of one, more about the collective consciousness that Ron was talking about, more about making sure that artists have control and that creativity remains in the hands of humans. I mean, this was the kind of thing that people were fighting for. And so there is, I think, a reason to be optimistic.
Cynthia Littleton, who's the co-editor-in-chief of Variety. Variety, as we mentioned, has been covering showbiz for 120 years.
1905. But that is, in fact, the year I started.
But. Okay. So Variety has seen, obviously, lots of changes in Hollywood. Where would you say the state of the business is now?
I will say that, just forgive me for plugging the home team, but Variety, one of the most enlightening things that I did during the strike was to go back and look in our pages and look at 1960, the last time that the Writers Guild of America and SAG-AFTRA were on strike together. And then I went back to 1980 and looked at the last time and the coverage, and it was so eye-opening. The patterns, the parallels, what was different, what was not. And that is, that benefit of hindsight really is helpful. I think in any conversation about a golden age, or is it, you know, is it over, is it ending? It's, I think, to understand what happened last year, you have to understand the context of how not only has television changed, viewers can tell that television has changed, the rise of Netflix and Hulu and other streaming services, the ability for people to, what we call, 10 years ago we called it time shifting, the ability for people to watch any show. You no longer have to show up Thursday at 9 to watch your favorite show. You can watch it at any time. That had ripple effects. It changed consumer behavior to a degree that forced Hollywood would have much preferred the old system. They made more money, they had more control, but technology really did put so much in the hands of viewers. Behind the scenes, for actors like Ron, for writers, there was so much change in the way television and movies were produced. The nature of the way people worked changed so much, so quickly. It's actually almost an embarrassment that it took a strike to bring all of that. It took a historic dual strike to bring all of that in perspective. We could see those changes in the moment, but the cumulative effect of industry, I mean, transition doesn't begin to describe what has gone on in Hollywood in this past decade and is going to continue into the, you know, certainly into this, well into this decade. There is a shaking out of corporate interests, and I'm sorry to say, but I think that in Hollywood, I think you're only going to see more consolidation in the coming years, and that is going to be challenging for individuals and unions. But I think to appreciate what we've been through, you have to understand, really have to understand just how much things have changed behind the scenes and what pressure it put on working Hollywood. And so going forward, you know, we're coming out of an age of 600 scripted television series, you know, one for almost two for every day of the week. That was although it was a bonanza of work, that was a bubble that was unsustainable, and when it eventually burst, it really burst. So there is so much to unpack, but I just want to say that also, I mean, at a moment when you can have things like a movie like Barbie, a television show that is distinctive as a show like Atlanta, you have a time when the what's possible in content is awe-inspiring. It's just a matter of getting to how people distribute, how they make money. That is the big challenge. That is the actors and writers made incredible strides, but the larger picture of how that monetization happens, and compared to the old world where they make, you know, where they just made sacks of money, now they're not making quite as much money. That is something that we're still in that messy middle of figuring
Selena
out.
At Mad Solar Productions, seeing you nodding along to our panels, they've been talking, and some smiles, and I think some are like sad smiles at some of the stuff that's going on. But give me that sliding scale of the difficulty for getting the projects off the ground, the stories that you want to tell in this era that we're in.
It's a great question. I will say, listening to Ron, the idea of content made to entertain and a collective consciousness coming together to enjoy something sounds so romantic, which is the thing that leans into sad. The fact that you almost can't even imagine what would it be like to watch something and collectively all of us have seen it at the same time and want to talk about it together. The amount of programming is so vast, which is exciting in the sense that there's something for everybody, but I do feel like it's a very fragmenting experience when you consider how art is ideally meant to bring us together, to give us something to share. None of us are wrong in what we're pursuing, but because we're not doing it together, there's something that we're all sort of missing tangibly that has traditionally come from this form of entertainment. I would say that in terms of the way that I look at the business and what's happened, in addition to the strikes last year, I found that one of the most significant moments was that Netflix subscriber drop, because what happened was this reflective turn that the bubble is bursting, this can't continue the way that it's going. And every other streamer, whether they were starting to see their stock prices drop or not, started to react with, oops, let's go broad and safe. Let's go as four quadrant, easy, inexpensive. Let's not take those risks, because if it's happening to Netflix, it can happen to us too, and we don't want to be next on that totem pole. In the same breath, the financiers traditionally who do more interesting or innovative stuff and then will lay it off to a buyer reacted the same way. Hang on a sec, money's harder to come by. Cost plus model is not paying us what it used to be. What are we going to do except for things that we really believe are going to sell in a broad marketplace to a broad in buyer interest? So everything, I think, has dropped. Well, I guess pendulum has swung to this drop in content production that I don't think is particularly interesting, but I do believe the pendulum always swings back and forth. I think that things are constantly in flux and constantly changing, even over the course of my time, even from that moment of House of Cards and True Detective at the same time where, I can binge TV and Matthew McConaughey is nominated for an Oscar and an Emmy in the same year, so you can pitch any piece of talent for television. There was such a significant shift there, and I do believe that things will continue to ebb back and forth, but my outlook, at least in my company, which is very culture facing, and we're partnered with Kid Cudi's and a constant dialogue with the kids, it's a very lives in that frame of mind. My reaction has been, well, if what are the kids paying attention to? They're gaming, they're reading comic books, they're watching animated programs, they're listening to music,
they're buying fashion, YouTube
more than anything else. I mean, I feel like on the artist spectrum, not to say that all artists need to diversify, because it's not an organic thing to ask, but at least for us, the reaction has been, play in different horizontals, because you're not then so beholden to the whims of the pendulum in our business.
Patrick Gomez, last but not least, editor-in-chief and general manager of Entertainment Weekly. So we heard Karina talking about the pendulum swinging back and forth. Where, in your view, is that pendulum now?
I mean, I think it's like going around in a circle, like a clock moving too fast. You know, as it was mentioned, we're in a state of flux right now. And to go back to a little bit of what Ron was saying, and also what we were talking about, the history, and when you look at the past strikes, the important thing to also is to take a step back and say, if you're not in the entertainment industry, if you work in, if you have a small business, you're going through a similar thing. You're watching all these consolidations and these conglomerates come in and take over and consolidate businesses. And you're missing the artistry and artisanship that went into making a piece of furniture from scratch, and it's all, you know, manufactured overseas. We're seeing this throughout our industries. It's not just entertainment, and so it's if you're not in the entertainment industry and you're looking for parallels, they're there, unfortunately, everywhere right now. And then not only to look back at former strikes, but I would look at the music industry, and they went through a whole reckoning of how do we grapple with technology coming in and changing our industry so rapidly. But they did take a minute and they figured out a way to at least be sustainable with the streaming platforms that are more legit and that you're actually able to be paid for your content. I think the other thing that was mentioned was YouTube and social media, and Gen Z and younger are looking at they're going to TikTok to type in, how do I cut bangs? How do I cook an omelet? They're not going to Google or even YouTube like some of us that are not that young. They're going to TikTok for those things. So the platforms are changing. And what's really cool about that is that there's a democratization of access to audience.
All right, that's all we have time for. A big thank you to our panelists for taking time out of a very busy award season schedule to be here for a very important conversation.
For the full show and more stories like this one, download the free Odyssey app and search KNX News, or go to knxnews.com/townhall. From Odyssey, this is Odyssey Conversations. Today, we take you to the Odyssey Sound Space in Los Angeles as KNX News anchors Charles Feldman and Mike Simpson discuss the state of the entertainment industry and how streaming is affecting the creative community and content they produce.
We have Ron Perlman, veteran actor, writer, producer, Hellboy. He was in Sons of Anarchy, Wing and a Prayer Studio. He's the founder and director. Cynthia Littleton, co-editor-in-chief at Variety. Karina Manischel, Mad Solar Productions. They did X, they did Pearl. Patrick Gomez, Entertainment Weekly, editor-in-chief, and Duncan Crabtree Ireland with SAG-AFTRA.
Cynthia, let's talk about what the audience is going to see, both in the movies and on television, on their phones, wherever they're watching it. To Ron Perlman's point, all of this reverse engineering doesn't sound like it's going to lead to very interesting, whether theatrical releases or programming on TV. Do you have any sort of hope that that is incorrect, that maybe Ron's wrong about that?
I think I want to just be, I would be a little contrarian to Ron, who gave did a great Patty Chayefsky performance here just a minute ago. Sorry, we don't have a window for you to hang out of, but I do think that, I think you look around and we can all, again, I keep fixating, but I think there is no algorithm that would tell you to make to give Greta Gerwig the tools to make the Barbie movie that she made. That had to be a gut check. That had to be, we believe in this person, we believe in their vision, and we've heard the stories of how that movie came, you know, that there were efforts to tuck it in, and she said, no, this is the movie, and the end result is the end result. There's no algorithm that says that people will flock to a three-hour movie about the father of the atomic bomb, as they did with Oppenheimer, a fantastic movie that came out this past year. You know, the folks at the programmers at the best places, at HBO, at FX, these are still people that at the end of the day read a script, assess talent, and say, I believe in this person. I'm going to back this person. HBO's fantastic miniseries Chernobyl is a perfect example. No algorithm would say that people would be moved by this piece of work, but they were. I think it still exists, but I think part of this ramp up of the peak TV, of getting to 600 series, of literally throwing content at the wall and see what sticks, I think that was not a golden age. It was a bubble. It was an unsustainable bubble. And especially, I think, as we, you know, got through the pandemic and toward the strike, really was a bookend. The strike, and also the event that Karina referenced, which was, if I have my math right, April of 2020. 2022 when Netflix, for the first time, had to acknowledge to Wall Street that they lost subscribers. That was when the bubble burst, because until that time, HBO Max and Paramount Plus and everybody was thinking the sky is the limit in terms of subscribers. We might get a billion subscribers, therefore we can spend as much as we can, as much as we can muster on content. When Netflix, which was the rocket that proved the model for everybody, when Netflix almost 2 years ago said, actually had to acknowledge that we're losing subscribers, that meant that the irrational exuberance that was driving every studio to spend, you know, 10x what they had been spending on content, because the prize was going to be those 1 billion subscribers, when the ceiling on Netflix's global growth seemed to be at about 250 at the point 2 years ago when they were losing subscribers. Just a couple weeks ago, they announced that they're gaining subscribers at a good clip. So it's up and down, but the important inflection points here are really important to remember. But back to the cusp of the crux of your question, I think that there is still a ton of creativity. There is so much, when talking to writers and actors on the picket lines, there is so much creativity and so much desire out there, but it is at a moment when just getting through that pipeline, even at a time of 600 shows, became harder than ever, and people were sort of banging their heads against the wall. Why? So I think the drop in production can only help.
We've talked a lot about TV, and I wanted, since you mentioned Barbie and Oppenheimer, I want to talk about movies here. And Karina, maybe Patrick, you want to chime in on this too. I mean, besides the big tentpole Barbenheimer phenomenon, are we getting butts in seats these days, or are the theaters and the studios still having trouble with that? And a lot, I think, changed during the pandemic. I talked to some people this morning. They were saying, you know, I just don't really have the drive anymore. I just wait. I wait till it comes on TV anyways. I can wait a few months. What's waiting a few months?
Really quickly, just to address, I think one of the things that's interesting about what was just being said about the streaming wars and trying to compete about how much content, that competition's always existed. You know, CBS and ABC and NBC always wanted to win whatever hour of television they currently had on. The answer to that was having the best content, and that was how you won, and that's how you got the better advertisers. What's difficult now is the business model is subscription-based, where it is less about that, because it's not a one-to-one competition of, oh, you've got Only Murders on the Building at the same time that we've got our prestige comedy. It's not that anymore. It's you could watch those two completely different times, and so that makes the competition a lot harder. But apologies, I totally didn't answer your question. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think it's a really valuable question. When I look at Barbie and Oppenheimer, what we can't forget is that Oppenheimer is one of the most celebrated filmmakers of our time. Barbie is, despite how incredible the take is still IP. So I do think that the traditional film system is still relying on what are the kind of broadest common denominators that are going to attract people that make them want to show up. And I think what you'd hope to see is, again, the romantic that Ron mentioned, where it's really about entertaining, it's really about capturing imagination, it's really about changing perspectives so that the studios feel more willing to invest in the next crop of artists and filmmakers and trust their visions, which are separate from something that's pre-existed, to give them opportunity. And I would love to see that moment. I think, too, it's interesting as I consider technology at large, and we touched on TikTok, we touched on the democratization of art, which I think is a key component as to what's happening here. If I'm a young artist, if I'm one of those geniuses, am I going to go through the traditional system and wait and hope that one of those studios is going to shift their perspective and give me a shot? Or best case, I get some piece of IP that they trust me with, but then I'm not really living into my authentic version.
Or are you writing and doing another superhero movie? I mean, we've had 50 of them.
No, but that feeling. So how can I make the next Marvel film feel different than what has existed before? It's not, I'm not necessarily putting my uniqueness onto that conversation. But then if it is a democracy, and if I can go to TikTok and I can go to these other mediums and express myself musically, artistically, exactly as I am, and monetize that potentially better and faster, is that a better use of my time? And I think part of the danger in what, you know, the system is invoking is less incentive for the young crop of artists to actually follow through with this side of the industry.
The nature of the way television in particular is produced has changed so much. And one thing that happened in a world of 600 shows, the idea of, it used to be in television, the goal was to have something, the goal was Law and Order, something that would go 20 years, ER 15 years, Grey's Anatomy 20 and counting. And that really changed in the era of streaming, because streamers had different, have different calculations. A show just has a shorter shelf life in streaming. And that has been one of the big things. Not only do shows have shorter season, you know, shorter number of seasons, but they produce fewer episodes. If you think of, you know, Law and Order, ER, they did 22 episodes a year. Now it's more like 8 or 10 episodes. And for actors and writers, that's 8 or 10 paychecks versus 22 paychecks. That's not hard math to do. That's just one of 100 things that we could sit and talk about in terms of the way things have changed.
Hold it right there for just a second. And again, we're listening to Cynthia Littleton, who's the editor-in-chief of Variety. And I'm sorry, did you want to continue?
Well, just that, I mean, it's, again, in so many ways that viewers can see, maybe might not be obviously evident, but that the nature of, you know, Ron was on a show called Sons of Anarchy. It was a show with a massive following. It was, you know, what television executives love more than anything is a renewable resource, a show that you can bank on is going to have a season 2 and a 3 and a 4 and hopefully get to double digits. And again, that whole calculation changed in the streaming era. You see shows, you know, the third and final season. I mean, that, you know, that used to be called failure. And now that is, again, because the feeling is that there's only so many episodes that a person is going to sample.
Yeah, is that a saving money phenomenon on the part of who's making those shows? Or is this, as we had kind of hit on before, you know, sometimes we just go with a safe bet, so you do something for a little while and then you trash it? Or is this an attention span thing that, you know, to talk about everyone on TikTok and YouTube, maybe we don't want Friends every Thursday night anymore for 7 years?
Well, it's a little bit of both, but as Duncan well knows, the salaries go up after season 4 and season 5 and season 6. So yeah,
everything used to disappear from Netflix after 3
all
seasons,
of a
right?
piece.
Yeah.
But it's not that we don't want it. This is Duncan speaking. It's not that we don't want it, because look at Suits. Suits on Netflix was the big breakout hit, if you want to call it that, of last year. And that's certainly not a 3-season show with 8 episodes per season. And, you know, I know a lot of people who are binge watching Suits who missed it on the first go round. So maybe that'll create a sense that maybe there is a room for more variety there.
Patrick Oham is editor in chief of Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah, I think what's interesting, though, is one, I think that there's binging of those things. And that's fantastic that shows can have a second life and find a new audience. But I was fortunate enough to get to go to the premiere of the Friends reunion on what is now Max. And they did it. It was during COVID. So they did it at a big outdoor venue in LA. And because it was finding a new audience, a younger audience, people that weren't even maybe alive when the show was originally on, they invited a lot of influencers and people that are famous on social media to help do promotion of it. And having them in the audience, they were doing a lot of trivia games and such in like the hour and a half before it started. And they were blasting them on the big screen. And what was great is that they were there and that this show found this audience. What was not great is to realize the difference in binge watching a show. And you might love 10 seasons of Friends, but because they're not having that cultural experience that Karina was talking about earlier of like watching something together, they were quizzing them on like iconic lines that any of us that watched that show in real time and every Friday went to either school or work and talked about it.
Pivot,
with our
pivot. Yeah,
exactly, right, pivot. But they were asking them like, you're my, I think most of us would know the end of that is Lobster. Because to them, it was just one more episode that they watched out of 10 they watched that day.
Is there a lot of dipping in and out these days of all these streamers? Because it used to be you could get them and save some money because you didn't want the cable bill, right? But now it's kind of like, I feel like people keep Netflix and then they get the other ones for a couple months and then they I'll get off of there.
But really that happened as well. I mean, if you just go back to HBO and Showtime, like HBO and Showtime, they see those same influxes. Like when Game of Thrones was on, they'd see an uptick in subscribers and then it would dip back down. So, and they clearly were able to make that sustainable. I think where it's difficult is the HBO kind of would take four or five big bets in a year and then have other programming that were smaller bets. And as long as they had something all year round, that was enough to keep people around, enough to make them profitable in a way that on streaming, they're trying to do that times 60 or sometimes 600. And that's when it gets unsustainable.
Although, you know, it's interesting. This is Duncan again. The data, there's an industry analytics company called Antenna that released recently some data about the churn rate on streamers. And it is noticeably different. It has gone up. You know, if you cross-reference it with the sort of decline in original content, there has been increased churn in most of the streamers. And it seems to me that what is happening right now is they are testing out, you know, what is the level of original content versus acquired content and library content that they need to have in order to keep their ideal, you know, level of subscribers. And so I think we haven't seen the result yet. We are in the middle of the experiment.
Well, I think the other thing that you're starting to see is that
That's Karina.
Hi. Sports is beating out content as far as a communal experience right now. And you're seeing the reflection from the streamers. I mean, you've got Amazon picking up Thursday Night Football, and now they're going to get a playoff game next year. You've got Paramount getting Champions League or Peacock getting Premier League or even Nickelodeon doing a simulcast of the Super Bowl, which was maybe one of the greatest pieces of content that's happened
SpongeBob
in recent years.
Fantastic.
He's pro-union.
It's fantastic, but that also, I mean, it's interesting. We talk about how much attention Taylor Swift has gotten for showing up in the Chiefs game and how that shifted the NFL and what that value means, but also you're seeing SpongeBob and Taylor Swift getting kids and their parents to watch football together. So I do think the traditional content, you're getting it major on the sports side.
All right, that's all we have time for. A big thank you to our panelists for taking time out of a very busy award season schedule to be here for a very important conversation.
For the full show and more stories like this one, download the free Odyssey app and search KNX News or go to knxnews.com/townhall.
I'm your host, Chris Arnold of 105 Through the Fan, and joining us today is Jesse Acosta. He's an educator who has taken things to the next level in the nonprofit world. He's got a nonprofit called Pesos for Oak Cliff. This nonprofit provides sneakers for kids while uplifting their confidence in academic achievement. Jesse, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. First of all, I think your entire concept for the nonprofit is absolutely unique. And sometimes being unique is what strikes the nerve with the people or the kids you want to reach out to. Can you talk about how you came up with the idea for Pesos for Oak Cliff?
Yeah, of course. Again, thanks for having me on. But yeah, as you said, right, I am an educator. I was a high school teacher for five years. Mm-hmm. Started in 2018. I did a year with AmeriCorps before that. So I guess you want to count that 6 years. But I grew up in Oak Cliff. If you are familiar with Oak Cliff and communities like Oak Cliff, people just know how big sneaker culture is.
Oh yeah.
It's just part of the community. It is part of what makes the community the community. And
it's a connector. Put it like this. It's a connector. It's not only just Oak Cliff. It's like around the country and literally because like basketball is around the world. People consume tennis shoes.
Nothing is more important than getting a good night's sleep. And when you don't get the rest you need, your whole day is thrown off. That's why it's so important to choose the right mattress. Sleeping on a Purple mattress is truly a unique experience because Purple mattresses are made with a gel flex grid. The gel flex grid is an innovative material that moves with your body to relieve pressure in areas like knees and hips and support in others like your back. It feels soft where you want it and supports where you need it. Purple mattresses instantly adapt when you move. You don't sink in and get stuck like with memory foam. And thanks to over 1,400 air chambers in the GelFlex grid, you will sleep cooler on a Purple mattress. Purple has a wide variety of mattresses, from the original Purple mattress to the Restore Hybrid Collection that combines GelFlex grid with coils, and the Rejuvenate Luxe Collection, the height of luxury, with over 112,000 five-star reviews to prove it. Visit purple.com to find the perfect Purple for you and enter code PODCAST10 to get 10% off.
AKA sneakers. And maybe it started in the 1980s with Michael Jordan and everybody had to get some Jordans. And now, you know, next level, you go down the different brands, but it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And of course, kids, they look for the shoes to drop. They used to wait in line outside of stores. And like you said, especially in Oak Cliff, it's almost like you talk sneakers and you're speaking a language that a lot of people identify with.
Correct. Yeah, everything you said is true, especially those Jordans, right? Like,
oh yeah,
I think everybody wants a pair. Growing up, I didn't have them. My parents could not afford it. But now that I'm an adult, I indulge that a little too much. But anyways, going back to the story. Yeah. So grew up in Oak Cliff, senior culture, came back as a teacher at the same high school that I graduated from, Justin F. Kimball High School.
Mm-hmm.
And go my Kimball shoes, Knights. I was that? Sorry.
I said, go Kimball Knights.
Oh, yes. They won the state championship last year for basketball. And yeah, so coming back into the classroom, using shoes as my leverage point to connect with the kids a little easier. Just by doing that, I made the observation that kids with worn out shoes were more likely to be bullied. Since they were more likely to be bullied, they would come less to class. They were coming less to class. Then their grades were not as great. And then it could just impact, you know, overall, if you really want to zoom out, graduation rates, college attendance rates, and so forth.
You know, you're right. Let's slow down a little bit because I think you're right. And a lot of people may not get it, but in a way, that's why certain schools have like school uniform policies so that other kids can't get bullied because, you know, they don't have what everybody else has, or somebody's balling out of control and they got all of their gear, their swag, and they're wearing it to school. And, you know, especially in North Texas, it's like, well, you know, we don't want the kids to be caught up in that as opposed to their education. And then you pinpoint shoes. Well, there's no policy on shoes. And so sometimes kids wear the latest Jordans. And then so there's some other kids who are like, I don't have nothing but, you know, the latest from Walmart.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So DISD, Kimball is part of DISD. There is no, probably in a couple campuses, maybe academies, but overall, yeah, there is no sneaker policy.
Right.
Where you have to wear proper footwear.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the high school level, it's definitely more dramatic. I think at the elementary level, kids are aware of what they're wearing, but I think they're not as conscious yet. Once you get older, it's really when it starts to hit the most. And so, yeah, it was just an observation that I made in 2018. Again, being a sneakerhead myself, it was just stood out to me, didn't do much about it. Not really until 2020. So skipping a couple of years here, pandemic hits. I was using this app Remind, not the Remind, sorry. Is it Remind? I think it is Remind, where I would use it to text my students just to check up how they were doing during COVID times.
Because it was virtual learning, right?
Right. Everything was shut down. We were not meeting in person. We were doing classes through Zoom. And a lot of them were just telling me about how their parents were either getting laid off, they were struggling economically, family members in the hospital, including myself. Like, I had grandparents that ended up in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And so I could relate to that. And, you know, my family, we're not rich or anything, but we were able to manage. So I couldn't imagine what it was for families that were really struggling. And anyways, trying to keep to a point here. I just wanted to do something for the community. I was involved in other nonprofits at the time, but I didn't feel fulfilled or like I was doing what I wanted to do. And so my girlfriend and I, Alejandra, she's also a huge sneakerhead. Decided to, what if we just do a 50 pair sneaker fundraiser? And the idea came from because we looked for other organizations here in DFW that were doing something like that, giving out shoes to kids in need. We wanted a fundraiser for them, but we didn't find any in DFW. Now there's a few besides us, but at the time there were none. Nobody was doing it. And so, yeah, we did a fundraiser. Our goal was $1,500
mm-hmm.
for 50 pair of shoes. And within a week, we fundraised $4,500-ish, and we were able to give out 150 pair of shoes.
Wow.
And from there, it's just history. From there, people kept asking, are you going to do it again? Small businesses really liked the idea. They wanted to support, but they wanted their tax write-off. So then we were like, well, let's become a nonprofit. Became a nonprofit, and yeah, this is how we're here today.
How did you come up with the name Pasos for Oak Cliff? Is it like for like K Pasa? What's happening?
So Pasos is steps in English, in Spanish, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a bunch of different names. One of them was Depths for Oak Cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And I can go into the Forward Cliff part here in a little bit, but I just didn't like how it sounded. Depths sounds a little boring.
Mm-hmm.
But this was also, 2020 was also city councilman election year. And so I kept seeing a bunch of signs of like, vote X for Oak Cliff, vote X for Oak Cliff. And I was like, well, what about a campaign where people donate and the funds actually are used in a, you're going to see some outcomes out of your funds, right? You're going to donate to a campaign. So mm-hmm. that's what we call the Pathways for Oak Cliff.
Okay, I see. We're talking with Jesse Acosta. He is the founder of Pathways for Oak Cliff. And Jesse, like I said, I think it's a brilliant idea. When you first started doing this, what were some of the reactions from the kids? And you can elaborate. I'm telling you, people love to hear the stories. I'm talking about positive, uplifting. Maybe somebody was kind of sad or there's some tears of happiness. Just what was the initial reaction when you first came up with the first batch of shoes?
Yes. I mean, so from our very first sneaker drive, I still remember this one little girl. She must have been, I don't know, maybe first, second grade.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it through all of them, but I mostly saw it through her because little kids, they're not afraid to react, honestly. We gave her shoes. I was going to take a picture of the shoes of her holding it, and I was trying to frame the shoe right over the box correctly so everything looked clean and clear, and she just wouldn't let me. She kept pulling away the shoes, thinking that I was going to take them back at the end of it. And that was sort of the reaction that I saw with a lot of the kids too. Because the shoes that we're giving out, they're Nikes, Adidas, mm-hmm. New Balance, name brand shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And for some of them, they I don't know, it just seemed like they thought it was going to be a prank or
it was too good to be true.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's one that's really stuck with me still since then, that she just wouldn't let me hold her shoes after I gave them to her. So that was really nice to see. And since then, we've had so many other stories, but I don't know. I think so. That was our first one. That one, I don't know. I think about it.
It touched your heart, didn't it? It touched your heart. You're like, wow, this is deeper than I thought. And again, I love the whole concept. And, you know, for those, again, don't know very much about Pathways for Oak Cliff, combating inequities in education, tackling the inequities from kindergarten through 12th grade, the education through various fronts. And you call it the Pathways way or the Pathways pathway. You've given correct. Out over 3,000 pair of shoes in the shoe drives. Is that right?
That is right. And by the end of the year, we should be at near 5,000.
That's amazing. So when you give them out, is it like a certain location? Talk about the concept of how, I mean, let's walk us through it. You're able to get the shoes. Tell us how are you able to get them in bulk on a discount? I know certain small business or partnerships you were able to gain, whether it's families or whatnot, there's like, okay, I can donate to this or it's a good tax write-off. Walk us through the process and then whether it's a location, a temporary location, a permanent location where, you know, the kids and the families are able to get these shoes.
Yeah, so it all starts with us partnering with the elementary schools, and most of them are in Oak Cliff. We have worked outside of Oak Cliff. Like, we've been to Austin, we've been to San Antonio, we've been to Fort Worth. So mm-hmm. we've been to these spots because we had a local business that heard about us and they were like, hey, we want to give you some money. Can you come out and do it over here? So we said, yes, we went out there and did it. So they've been sort of maybe like one of or two times that we've been there in those locations, but here in Dallas, right, we do most of our work. We partner with the local elementary school. Sometimes they'll reach out to us. They'll let us know what they need.
Mm-hmm.
And we take into account their low income level. And for that, we use a TEA data that's published that everybody can go look at.
Mm-hmm.
So once we get the shoe sizes from the schools, comes the buying the sneaker part. And how we do that is through a combination of two different things. The first one is the donations. So donations that we've been acquiring through fundraisers or just people, you know, reaching out to want to donate. We personally, Alejandra and I, usually most of the time, we go to the Nike outlet, we go to Foot Locker and all these different brand stores to go find the best shoes, but at a good price point. A lot of people think that we do have a deal with, for example, Nike or whoever it might be. We don't. So if anybody out there is listening and they're interested, hey,
You never know.
Come reach out.
You never know. And you'd be surprised who listens to this show and they say, you know what? Let's do a direct partnership with this nonprofit. You'd be surprised.
Right. And we don't mind. And listen, like I've always said this, like if we ever do have somebody reach out, I don't expect anything for free. We'll keep buying it from them. Just give us a discount because it does help. But anyways, so most, I would say about 98% of the shoes we give out, Alejandra and I, we personally hand-picked out these shoes for the kids. The other small percentage are brand new shoes that were donated from just people that want to donate. And so we do have drop-off locations at Center, Bishop Arts, Everyday Works as a coffee shop by Elementary here in Oak Cliff. And then the last one that we just established is Dope Street Streetwear, which is in Bellum. And all of those addresses are on our website, bastosforoc.org. So if anybody does want to drop off brand new shoes or even slightly used shoes, because we do get those sometimes where the shoes are really good, but they're slightly used.
Let's call them gently used.
And if we can't give them out, what we'll do with those is we'll sell them and put the money back in the fund. So they still go to something good.
That is fantastic. Jesse Acosta, you were talking about some of the stories about how the kids, you know, felt uplifted because, wow, you know, the shoe game is so real. And it's like, okay, this is like currency. And, you know, I feel a little bit more pride, a little bit more self-esteem. I can fit in a little bit better. Can you talk about the reaction or how, like, the word spread? I mean, when the word started spreading? And then what were the kids saying to you when they were coming up to you? And not just the kids, but maybe their families as well.
Yeah, so it's just been really organic. As I mentioned earlier, after the first drive, it really started with our friends, our friends sharing it. So we're really active on social media. So that's helped a lot too, just leveraging the power of social media with everything that we do to get the word out, get the message across. And even through those posts, you can, depending on the post, you can go and check what families are saying about what we're doing for their kids, for them. And overall, just the reaction of the whole community has been amazing. Especially when you get those families that, I don't want to share too much personal from them, but just those stories that they share with us, whether it's through email or personal, or sometimes, like I said, they just don't really mind putting it out there on social media that you can find some of these. It just keeps growing. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, it really does, because it's about, you know, like you said, it's about self-esteem. It's also a way of communicating. And again, you're trying to reach a target audience, which is the kids, in something that they're interested in, as opposed to talking about like biology and like, oh, I don't really care about frogs. You know, it's like there's a way of communicating. And then all of a sudden you're able to get messages across, like, make sure you get your grades, make sure you do this. Or guess what? You do have an opportunity to get ahead in life. Or this is not where it has to be if you want to change things in your life. And I understand you guys have also given away like $38,000 worth of scholarships. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because that's also very impressive.
Right. So thank you for mentioning the things you mentioned earlier. Clearly, we're collecting also surveys from our families, right? So they are proving to us that the program is working, the sneaker program is working. Is it helping kids go to school more? Yes, it is. Because they're in school more, they're doing better in the classroom. That increases chances of graduation. And we're tracking these kids along the way too. But to the scholarship, you know, so Alejandra, she's a DACA recipient. When she was applying to college, she had a hard time finding scholarships. And Oak Cliff is a mix of both worlds. That is Hispanic and African-American. And you do have other ethnicities, but, you know, they're really small in population and pockets, depending on where you're at in Oak Cliff. And so just inspired by her experience with DACA and everything going on with that. And also knowing that some of the kids we work with that have been sneaker recipients, some of them, they don't have the best grades, not because they chose not to, but maybe they were occupied with other things at home. Maybe they had to work a job. They had to help out family members with finances. So the grades might not be the best. So we created a scholarship that is not restrictive to where you're from, that's not restrictive to were you the best performing student in your school, but it's more about what are you trying to achieve? What are your dreams? Are you willing to work for it? How can we help you navigate those issues that you might be going through that kept you from being the best student in high school? And yes, we have distributed over $35,000 worth of scholarships. And some of these students, they are in Texas. Some of them are in New York, in California. They're all over the place at this point.
Wow, that's impressive.
And as I mentioned, we do follow up with them to see, hey, how are you doing in college? Because we also see them as an investment that we hope eventually they come back to the city of Dallas, get a job here, start a business, whatever it might be, and pump back into the economy so we can continue to grow as a city.
And speaking of kids doing well, I understand you've got a summer program as well. I think you have over 30 students enrolled. And I guess the best way to put it is PASOS is closing the gap of rising ninth graders in literacy and math by combining academics with sneaker design and our PASOS All-Stars Enrichment Program. Please elaborate. I'm loving this.
Yes. So the All-Stars program, it's a heavy one. There's so many components that go into it, as you mentioned, right?
Take your time. We got time.
The primary goal was, so it started off, again, going back with the shoes. We saw the kids were doing better in the classroom. They're going to school more. But we were wondering, how do we take that an extra step? Especially after we came back after COVID, kids were just not, and still to this day, that gap hasn't been really fulfilled or closed yet in literacy and math. And I was a history teacher. One thing that my kids would always tell me was that they loved my class, which I was surprised, to be honest with you, because history can be really boring, but I guess I found a way to make it fun. So thinking about all those things and being like, what am I doing that makes history fun? And what I was doing was what I was able to pinpoint after asking the students was that I was bringing in local history. So I was making history more relevant to what they actually like and know. And that's sort of where the light bulb went off. Like, well, what if we take sneakers because they love shoes and we combine it with literacy and math? And that's how the All-Stars program came about. And so everything our kids read about are about shoes. And now we started doing filmmaking, so it's grown into more than just sneakers. But either they're reading about sneakers, they're reading about film and math, they're doing problems about the sneaker industry, or they're doing problems about film. And it's grown into this multi-tier program now. So we have our freshmen that do sneaker design when they come in with us. That's how we get them. They all love that route. And we expanded on that because sneaker design, there's more than just designing a shoe, like sitting down and drawing on paper. There's marketing. There's visual storytelling. There's so many skills that you learn through designing a shoe that you can apply in other things. And that's how filmmaking came about. If we have the shoe, well, now how do we market that shoe? So our sophomores create short films around that shoe. And right now we're working on a third-year track for our juniors in terms of web development. So taking the photos from the shoes that the kids took of the sneaker design, taking the film that was created and making a gallery online of where everything lives on our website. And again, that's going to be new this year. Right now, if you visit our website, you're not going to see a whole lot, but by the end of the summer, you're going to see the films and the sneakers all living in our website. And that would all be created by our students this year. And yeah, so the program has really evolved into just more than sneaker design. It's evolved into equipping our kids with workforce readiness skills, but also closing those gaps in literacy and math so they become better students, increasing their chances of graduating high school. And college is not the end goal here. I think we've become to realize that it's a whole new society now. I used to be a huge proponent of like, you got to go to college. Now I've really changed my mindset around like college is sometimes not necessary depending on what you want to do. And that's what we're trying to teach our kids. So if you don't want to go to college, at least we've given you some skills that you can leverage to try to get a higher paying job right out of high school.
Exactly. The whole point of not just college, but any education is to allow you to have a career that you're successful in. It will allow you the opportunity to have a great life and take care of your family or take care of yourselves. and therefore you're a vital part of society and not necessarily a burden in society where you have nothing to look forward to. You have nowhere to go. You have no skill set to pass along. And it's not just college, like you said. And I love the fact that you're showing them marketing opportunities and design opportunities, because in this day and age, seriously, I've talked to so many different marketing execs and different people and different nonprofits where, you know, you could create a YouTube page and next thing you know, it's no different than the dot-com boom in the late 1990s where, you know, these guys were coming up with stuff online and nobody ever heard about online. And now everybody knows social media and marketing online is a huge part of the advertising pie, and major advertising companies are always looking for different angles of reaching different kind of markets, different cultures, different opportunities, and reaching especially people under the age of 30. And I think you might have tapped into some things. I mean, it's absolutely, it's wild to think about. You ever think about like that, Jesse, about how big this could really be? You never know. One kid could all of a sudden wind up with a deal with, let's say, Nike or New Balance or Adidas, or you just name it. It's like, whoa, they were able to take this skill set that they worked on through, you know, Pasos for Oak Cliff and turn it into life-changing finances that could change not just their lives, but their family's lives and maybe even this area. It's hard to believe, but that's how these things happen.
No, you're absolutely right. It's going to take some time to see those results, right?
Sure.
Right now we see the immediate in academics, but as we keep pushing the program forward and the kids coming back, I am excited to the day that we see those things where, oh, one of our kids is working for Nike now, or one of our kids is working, I don't know, designing, creating commercials or something.
Right.
Like I'm looking forward to that day that we're able to see those fruits come out. And like you said, you know, at the end of this, Basel's started off as just a sneaker nonprofit to help out kids in need with shoes, and we should do that, but it's become so much more. Now it's about being intentful about, it's not a handout, it's a hand up.
Yes, I like the way you put
breaking
that.
Breaking the cycle of poverty.
Mm-hmm. It's creating opportunity for those who don't see the opportunity yet. And like I said, you speak in their language in a currency that they all love, which is sneakerdom, or the worlds of sneakers. And I want to go back to what you said earlier about how you had worked with some nonprofits. In a way, you actually learned some things along the way to basically help set you up to start Pasos for Oak Cliff. Can you talk about the challenge of starting a nonprofit? Because a lot of quote unquote corporate business people always tell me nonprofit founders are the most courageous people in the world, because it's taking that really big leap. They're right up there with small business owners. Just like you take that leap of faith and you believe in what you're doing and you live it out. Can you talk about the getting into the nonprofit part and maybe some of the ups and downs that you've learned along the way? Because nothing is ever like straightforward climb to the top. It's always full of twists and turns.
Oh, definitely. And we still see those twists and turns as a small nonprofit. Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing that I learned before starting this nonprofit, being part of other nonprofits, was that you have to be open-minded to ideas, especially from those that might be younger from you. And that's just, again, speaking from my experience with the other nonprofits, it was usually really driven by the top dogs in the organization, and newer, fresh ideas were shut down. And in fact, I completely forgot to mention this earlier, but before we started Pasos, we did consider taking it to another nonprofit,
mm-hmm.
To make it sort of like a subdivision, just a sneaker drive. Hence, I'm glad we didn't do that. Here
right.
we are. But anyways,
mm-hmm.
Yes, starting it, I'll be honest with you, most of the things, because my background is not a nonprofit, besides being part of an organization, most of the stuff was, we taught ourselves just by Googling it.
That's right. Yeah, Google is your friend. I tell that to all kinds of people. They're like, I wonder if Google is your friend. Just Google it up.
It is. And I mean, I'll clearly just make sure whatever you're reading is credible information.
Exactly. Of course. Cross check it.
And say it was a lot of YouTube videos, a lot of reading on Google, buying nonprofit books and just teaching myself how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we filed to become a 501c3, a lot of websites said to get a lawyer. I didn't have lawyer money. How to figure it out, how to do it myself. And we did it correctly.
There you
thank
go.
God. Same thing when we became a tax exempt. Mm-hmm. I just read a bunch of books, consoles and videos, and we filed it ourselves. And I think what, you know, as I mentioned earlier, when we first started, there was nothing, and there still is really nothing like us in DFW. I have not seen a nonprofit that's doing what we're doing here, because we were so new at the time. Now we're about to be 4 years old in August.
Time flies.
Donations were really good. And now that we've been around a little longer, now I'm starting to see this is where the real work begins. Not saying that starting it was easy either. There was a lot of sacrifices. I was still teaching full time, doing puzzles on the side. I was working essentially from 7 a.m. till about 12 in the morning every day, just trying to run both jobs. Now I have transitioned into being a full time nonprofit executive, but with that comes lower pay, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot of sacrifices.
That's the risk. That's the risk reward and the courage to see it through.
Right. But seeing the successes is definitely worth it. Like getting to talk to you, for example, is definitely a huge win for 2024.
Put it like this. I'm honored to talk to you because I think your story is so unique. It deserves to be shared as well as we can. And again, you never know who might reach out to you and say, you know what, I want to partner with you, or I think this is a great opportunity and I want to volunteer and be involved. And you mentioned the fact that, you know, being the nonprofit with this idea, it's unique in North Texas and the highs and the lows. And right now, you know, you're steadily making progress and the word has gotten out. The website is nice and I love the website. Can you tell everybody again how they can reach you on the website?
Yeah, so on the website, it's again, pasos4oc.org, PASOSFOROC.org. There's multiple ways that they can find the contact us, or they can also just email me. It is my last name, acosta@pasosforoc.org. If anybody wants to get involved or do a fundraiser for us, that's one thing we've been looking for, more partnership-driven fundraisers. That's one thing that I've learned too, right? Mm-hmm. That people tend to give to friends rather than organizations recently. This is usually that came out about this, but yes, that's how they can reach out to us.
Thanks, Jesse, and thank you all for joining us on Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact here in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold. So long, everybody.